It was after dark when Fargo, Ford, and the others rode into the tiny town of Mesquite. Although it was dark, the town was still sweltering, slowly giving off the heat it had absorbed during the day. It lay before them, bathed silver under the full moon. The buildings of the little town were, for the most part, low-lying structures of adobe. However, here and there could be seen houses of unpainted ripsawed lumber. Little squares of light projected through a few of the windows, forming dim yellow patches in front of the buildings. As the four men rode up the street, they passed in and out of the splashes of light.
Hey, Fargo. It's been a long, hard ride. What do you say we tie up here for a little while and get us something to drink?
You got any money, Dagan?
No, but you do.
What makes you think that?
I know you took a whole packet of money out of the money pouch, because I seen you do it.
Yeah, I did. But for now, that's all we got left. We gotta make it last till we get our money back.
What's the use of having it if we don't spend it?
Come on, Fargo. Dagan's right. I gotta have me something to drink to get the dust out of my throat. Hell, I'm so dry I can't even work up a good spit.
You ain't just whistling Dixie, Casey. And I'd like something to eat, too. Or was you maybe planning on starving us to death?
All right. There ain't no reason to be an asshole, Monroe. We'll stop and get us something to eat and drink. Just quit your belly aching. I need to ask a few questions anyway.
The brightest building in town was clearly the canteen, with bright golden light shining through every window. It was easy to see why the inside was so brightly lit. It was accomplished by the expedient of using two wagon wheels suspended from the ceiling, each of which supported half a dozen lanterns. In addition to the overhead light, there were several lanterns placed on shelves around the walls. Mesquite was further north than Sasabe Flat, and whereas Sasabe Flat had been almost all Mexicans, in this little town there appeared to be nearly as many Americans in the bar as there was Mexicans. Fargo found the table and corn.
I'm gonna order us some beans, bacon, and cornbread.
And beer. Don't forget the beer.
And whiskey.
And women. Don't forget to send some of them women over.
Slow the hell down. We ain't got time for no women. You seen what happened to us the other night when we was messing with the women.
Yeah, but that don't count. Because it was one of us what done it to us. And there ain't none of us gonna do something like that to us again. Not without I kill them first.
Monroe, I'm sure there must be some sense in what you just said. But damn if I can figure it out.
Evidently, Fargo's admonition to his men to avoid the women had not reached the women themselves. For as the men were eating, a couple of the bar girls came up to the table. Like the other girls in the cantina, like Carmelita and Rosita from the other night, both of these soiled doves were Mexican. They had long black hair and smooth, clear skin that shined golden in the lantern light. One of the soiled doves was a little younger than the other. She was considerably prettier than most bar girls any of the men had encountered. Somehow, she sensed that Fargo was the leader of the group, and she sidled up to stand beside
him. My, all of you are such handsome hombres.
We're more than handsome, honey. We're very...
I'm looking for an American whore.
Oh, senor, you do not want an American? The blood of American whores runs cold. The blood of Mexican whores runs hot.
She emphasized her comment by arching her back proudly and pushing her pelvis forward.
Don't you want me, senor?
I told you. I'm looking for an American whore. You know a whore named Susie?
Susie? Si, senor, we know Susie. But I think you will like Frederica and me better than Susie.
This one's Frederica? What's your name?
I am Eva.
Well, Eva, me and my boys here has rid a long ways and we're hungry and thirsty. But as soon as we eat and drink, why, I reckon we could show you and little Frederica here a thing or two.
No, we could not, goddammit all to hell! I told you, boys, we ain't got time for none of this. Leastwise, not till we get back what's rightfully ours. Frederica, I want Susie.
Sorry, senor, but Susie is not here now.
You don't have time for us, but you have time for a gringo girl?
Honey, I got time for you. It don't take me very long at all. Hey, Fargo, come on. What do you say a few of us take a little time off and go upstairs with
no!
you?
Where is Susie, Frederica?
She's in her crib, senor. But I know she will not see you now. She has a man with her. And I think he will stay the night.
Who is he? Who is the man with her?
I do not know his name.
What's he look like?
He's a gringo. How can I tell you what he looks like? All gringos look the same.
You can't tell me nothing about him? Tall, short, beard, no beard, cowboy, miner?
He is not tall. He is not short. He does not have a beard, but he needs a shave.
Fargo took out $2 and put the money on the table.
Are you sure that's all you can tell me?
Maybe I can tell you something more. He has a limp.
Son of a bitch! Fargo, it's him! Susie's with Ponzi!
I told you boys we'd find him. Come on. Let's go see the son of a bitch.
It will do you no good to see the gringo, senor. Susie will not see you.
Oh, I think she will.
Don't you ladies go anywhere. We'll be back.
Don't count on it, Casey.
At a table in the back corner of the saloon, Billy Cates turned so that Fargo Ford wouldn't see his face. Billy had once ridden with Fargo. They'd had a falling out over some money. Billy and his friend Les Wilson accused Fargo of cheating them on their share of the money they'd stolen from a general store over in Cholla. They settled the argument with guns. When it was over, Fargo rode away with all the money, leaving Billy wounded and Les dead on the floor. Billy had gone straight ever since then. He was working now as a cowboy on a ranch just outside of Mesquite. He didn't want to renew his acquaintance with Fargo Ford under any circumstances. He stayed there with his back turned until Fargo and the others went outside.
Do you know where to go, Fargo?
Yeah, I know where a crib is.
Listen, Fargo, since you wouldn't let us have nothing to do with Frederica or Ava, how about while you're dealing with Ponzi, not you, but you mind if the rest of us, I know she's your sister, but she is a whore and all.
After we take care of Ponzi, we ain't gonna be standing around long enough for nothing like that. Besides, you think I'm just going to stand around and let you screw my sister?
Well, why the hell not? You said yourself she's a whore.
Yeah, Fargo, what do you say? I mean, you could come back here with one of them Mex girls while the rest of us poke your sister.
Ugh. Unless you got a thing against us doing what everyone else is doing to your sister.
Now, you could all three screw her at the same time wearing sombreros and farting Oh Susanna, as far as I'm concerned. That ain't got nothing to do with it. After we get finished with Ponzi, I don't think it'll be all that smart for us to be hanging around here.
Oh, yeah. I reckon I see what you mean.
The quartet stopped down the street before a leather goods store. A sign hung from an iron rod that protruded from the front of the store. Arm Brewster's Leather Goods. Saddles, boots, holsters, belts. H. Arm Brewster, proprietor. Next to the leather goods store was White's Apothecary. It didn't have an overhanging sign, but there was a painting on the window of a mortar and pestle. Fargo dismounted and handed the reins of his horse to Casey.
You boys wait here and take care of the horses. And when I come out of there, I don't want to be picking my nose and scratching my ass while I look for my horse, like what happened to us back in Calabasas.
You don't need to be worrying about none of that. Your horse will be here when you come back. I promise.
Oh, I ain't gonna worry none, Dagan. If my horse is gone when I come back, I'll just kill you and take yours.
Hey, how come I don't see Ponce's horse anywhere?
The son of a bitch ain't that dumb. He's not likely to leave his horse tied up out on the street where we could see it now, is he? I mean, you have to know he's figuring on us coming after him.
Fargo pulled his pistol and started walking through the narrow passageway between the leather goods store and the apothecary. He continued on down the constricted path between the two buildings until he reached the alley. Then he saw his sister's crib. It was on the other side of the alley, a small one-room shack made of unpainted wood. A very dim light, which Fargo supposed was a candle, glowed from inside the little crib. Fargo walked very quietly to the front door and slowly tried the door handle. The door was locked. But Fargo knew where Susie kept a spare key. He reached up into the eaves and poked around with his fingers until he felt it. Then, putting the key in the lock, he turned it very carefully. Fargo stepped inside with his gun arm extended before him.
What the hell?
Ponzi, you son of a bitch! Do you think you'd get away with it? Oh!
Fargo hurried over to the bed and jerked the sheet down.
Holy shit! This ain't Ponzi! Who's this?
Fargo! What the hell has gotten into you? What are you doing?
Stop it, goddammit!
Why'd you come in here and shoot like that?
Stop hitting me! Oh, I thought it was Ponzi.
That's it? You thought it was Ponzi, so you came in here shooting?
I'm sorry.
You're sorry? You're fucking sorry? You break in, kill the man in my bed, scare me to death, and all you can say is you're sorry?
Ow! Shit! Quit it, Susie!
Shut the damn door!
Right. Sorry. I told you I thought it was Ponzi. Where is Ponzi anyway?
How the hell am I supposed to know? I haven't seen Ponzi in nearly a year. I thought he was with you.
If he was with me, I would have already killed the son of a bitch instead of coming here.
Yeah, well, you didn't do it. You just killed Jim Hessler.
Now, who's Jim Hessler?
That's Jim Hessler. He worked in the general store. What made you think it was Ponzi?
One of the mech's whores down in the cantina told me the man you were with has a limp. Does this man have a limp?
He doesn't have anything now, you ignorant bastard.
All right, before I killed him, did he have a limp?
Yes, he had a limp. One of his legs was deformed.
Yeah, well, then you can see that it was an honest mistake. She said he had a limp, so I thought it was Ponzi.
What the fuck are you talking about? Ponzi doesn't have a limp.
Well, he does now. It's sort of a long story.
Listen, you better get out of here. And if I were you, I'd leave town.
How are you going to handle this? What are you going to tell the sheriff when he finds a dead man in your bed?
Oh, I don't know. I guess I'll just tell him what happened. That someone broke in here and shot him. Oh, don't worry, I won't tell him who did it. I'll just say I don't know who it was.
What if they blame you?
They're not going to blame me. As soon as you're out of here, I'm going to start screaming bloody murder. Anyway, do you really give a shit if I get blamed for this? Now get the hell out of here.
Thanks. Good seeing you.
Fargo left the house and scurried back to his companions.
Hurry up! There's people coming!
Did you get the money?
No.
What the hell? You killed the son of a bitch and you didn't even get the money?
Look, down there! There's riders in front of Arm Roosters!
This is a sheriff. You men hold it right there.
Throw a few shots their way and let's get the hell out of here.
The shooting had the desired effect because the crowd scattered just as Fargo thought they would.
Let's go!
Falcon had seen scores of army posts just like Fort Lowell all over the West. But unlike the forts of the Northwest, this one did not have a palisade. Instead, it had a low-lying rock fence, more as a means of marking out the property than providing any protection. But there was a front gate, from which hung a sign denoting this as the Fort Lowell Military Reservation, and the gate was manned by an armed guard. As Falcon and Sheriff Corbin approached the gate, the guard, a young private, stepped out to meet him. He held his rifle at the high port position.
Halt! Dismount!
Falcon and Corbin swung down from their horses and, holding the reins, approached the guard.
Who are you? And what is the purpose of your visit?
Private, I'm Sheriff Corbin from Oro Blanco. This is my deputy.
What can I do for you, Sheriff?
We are here on official business. I need to speak with the fort commander.
Wait here. Corporal of the guard, prepare to post number one.
Corporal of the guard, prepare to post number one. Corporal of the guard is preparing to post number one.
The corporal of the guard will be here shortly, sir.
A moment later, the corporal arrived. He was overage for his grade, and the corporal's corpulent body and patchy red face suggested that his lack of rank might be related to his love of drink.
What is it, Private Wilson? What's the problem?
These men are here to speak with Colonel Dixon.
I'm Corporal Mixon. You are here to see the Colonel?
We are.
What do you want to speak to the Colonel about?
That's between us and the Colonel.
No, it ain't between you and the Colonel, not unless I say it is. I'm in charge here, so I'm the one you are going to have to deal with. Now, what do you want to see the Colonel for?
I'm going
to
tell you one more time. What we want to talk to your commandant officer about is none of your business. It is between the Colonel and us.
In that case, the answer is no. You cannot see the Colonel. Good day.
The corporal spun on his larded butt and headed back to the gate.
Wait here for a moment, Sheriff. Let me talk to him. I'm pretty sure I'll be able to raise him with it. Corporal, wait a minute. Let's see if we can't work this out.
I thought you might come around. So, you going to tell me what you want to talk to the Colonel about?
No, but I do believe we can work this out. You see, I'm going to give you one more opportunity to take us to see him. And I think you ought to take it. Because if you don't, I don't think you will care much for the consequences.
You are going to give me one more opportunity? All right. You've given me my opportunity. So what happens now if I don't take it? What consequences are you talking about?
If you don't honor our reasonable request, I'm going to break every bone in your body, starting with your fingers, then working my way up. And I'll finish with that empty gin glass you call a skull.
The corporal gazed into Falcon's eyes, looking for any hint that he was being anything less than serious. As a reply, Falcon cracked his knuckle.
I think I can get you in to see him.
I thought you might see it my way. Come along, Sheriff. The corporal and I have worked things out.
Oh, it's all right. I'll take you to see the colonel. You just follow me.
Well, I'll be damned. He must have a silver tongue, Falcon.
Yeah, I can be pretty damn persuasive when I want to be.
Falcon and Sheriff Corbin retrieved their horses and followed the corporal from the front gate and out onto the post toward the headquarters building. The fort was laid out around a large square parade ground, fronted on all four sides by the buildings of the garrison. Most of the buildings were two-story wooden barracks buildings. The parade ground was a large rectangle with the barracks buildings and mess halls on each of the longer sides. The stables and corral occupied one end of the rectangle, while the post hospital and sutler's store sat at the opposite end. Midway down the far side of the parade ground, and situated right behind the flagpole, was a brick building. This was the only brick building on the entire fort, and it was to this building that the trio were headed. A white sign in front of the brick building featured cross swords in gold, while in black letters were the words, Fort Lowell Military Reservation, Headquarters, 5th Cavalry Regiment, United States Army, Post Commandant and Regimental Commander, Fred M. Dixon, Colonel of Cavalry.
This here is the orderly room. You can tie your horses off here.
Thanks.
Sheriff Corbin and Falcon wrapped their reins around the rail. Then they followed the corporal up onto the little wooden porch, and Corporal Mixon knocked on the door.
Enter!
Inside the orderly room of the headquarters buildings, they saw a tall, impressive-looking, clean-shaven NCO who was sitting at a desk in front of a large wall map of Pima County, Arizona. A sign on the NCO's desk read, Seamus O'Reilly, Regimental Sergeant Major.
What is it, Corporal Mixon?
Sergeant Major, these here men are the sheriff and his deputy. They want to speak to the colonel, but I don't know what about.
I wouldn't think that you would. It's not your business to know. If they want to speak to the colonel, then their business is with him.
Yes, but don't you think it
Don't try to think, Mixon. It's not your strong suit.
Yes, Sergeant Major.
The Sergeant Major did not try to impress Falcon and the sheriff with his position. Instead, he stepped up to the door of the colonel's office.
Enter.
O'Malley stepped inside. No more than a minute later, he was back outside.
If you gentlemen will go on in, the colonel will see you.
Colonel Dixon, who had stood to meet them, was the perfect portrait of an army officer, trim and fastidious about his dress and person.
Gentlemen, welcome to Fort Lowell. I'm Colonel Dixon.
Colonel Dixon, I'm Sheriff Corbin from Morro Blanco. This is my deputy.
Well, Sheriff, what can I do for you?
We've had an incident with the Indians, the Kababi Mountain Band.
Yes. I believe they are the ones under Katano, are they not?
They are.
The Kababi Band are mostly Chiricahua.
I wouldn't say that. As you know, most of the Chiricahua have been moved to Oklahoma. There are some Chiricahua left, of course, and many of them are with the Kababi Band. But Katana's village is actually a mixture of Western Apache, Jicarilla, and of course those few remaining Chiricahua I mentioned.
You said there was an incident. Are you talking about the three prospectors who were killed? Because I already know about them. It's a bad thing, but the truth is, those men were on Indian land, so there's not a whole lot we can do about it.
No, I wish that was what we were here about, but that ain't it. This here incident might wind up starting a war with the Kababi, and if it does, I don't mind telling you, it'll be our fault.
What do you mean, our fault?
By our fault, I mean white men. More specifically, Fargo Ford and his gang.
Fargo Ford. Yes, I've heard of him. But he's an outlaw, isn't he? What does he have to do with an Indian problem?
Ford held up a stagecoach and took one of the passengers off the stage. That passenger was Cloud Dancer, Kitano's daughter. She had finished school and was coming home. Turns out that the coach was carrying a money shipment, so Ford waited at the top of the Cerro Pass, held up the stage, and took her off the coach.
Is he holding her somewhere?
He killed her.
Do you know this for a fact?
Yeah, we found her body. My deputy took her back to her father.
I'll be damned. Deputy, I don't know whether to praise you for your courage or damn you for your foolhardiness. Maybe both. It's a wonder Kitano let you out alive. So, Sheriff, if your deputy took the girl's body back and got out alive, why are you here to see me?
The other day, a drummer left Oro Blanco, driving a buckboard up to Arivica. He was driving a rented team, and the next day, the team brought the buckboard back to the livery stable. The drummer, a man named Arnold Johnson, was in the back, mutilated and scalped.
And you think it was retaliation for the chief's daughter?
I think it was indirect retaliation.
After that business with the prospectors, I was afraid it might come to this. All right, I'll ask General Miles for orders to put the 5th Cavalry into the field.
No, don't do that, Colonel. At least not yet. I don't think there's any need for you to call out anyone. I don't believe this is a war with the Kababi Band. I think this is nothing more than one ambitious Indian who's been able to talk 3 or 4 others into following him. So far, Kitano's on our side. Or at least he's keeping most of the warriors back on the reservation. The one who's causing all the trouble is Naiche's nephew, Chitopa.
Chitopa? I'm not sure I've ever even heard of him.
Yeah, well, that's probably Chitopa's damn problem. No one's ever heard of him, and he's not happy about it. He wants his name to be spoken in the same tone as Naiche and Geronimo. If you turn out the army, you'll be giving him exactly what he wants. It'll not only give him the notoriety he's looking for, it'll give him the opportunity to recruit more warriors.
If you don't mind my asking, how would you propose that we take care of him without turning out the army?
You don't need an army to take care of him. I'll take care of him myself.
Aren't you afraid you might be biting off more than you can chew?
Colonel Dixon, maybe it's time I introduce this fellow to you. I didn't give you his name. It's McAllister. Falcon McAllister.
The hell you say? The Falcon McAllister? The gunfighter who killed Naiche? Well, I'll be damned.
He stuck out his hand a second time.
I am pleased to meet you, Mr. McAllister. General Miles said you were a one-man army. I reckon if any man could take care of this Chitopa person, you'd be the one. Is there anything you'd like the army to do?
You might send a few patrols out. If you see any prospectors getting over onto Indian land, discourage them. And while you're at it, it would strengthen my hand greatly if you'd open up that dam and let some of the Santa Cruz River water back on the reservation.
I can't do that. I wish I could, Mr. McAllister. In fact, I think the Indians are being cheated out of their rightful supply of water. The Indian agents made an appeal to the territorial governor, but the governor hasn't made a decision yet. He figures there are too many white people who want the dam to stay closed. And if he does anything, they'll cry to Washington, and he'll wind up losing his job.
With all due respect, the territorial governor is a civilian appointee who's afraid to take a piss without getting authorization from Washington. Forget him, he's an idiot. You make the decision. You alone. That's what good army commanders do, right? They make tough decisions.
Falcon had perceived that Colonel Dixon was an officer of honor, integrity, and pride, and he knew this approach would appeal to him. Dixon smiled and nodded.
You're right. That is exactly what army commanders do, and it is what I should have done a long time ago. All right, Mr. McAllister, you can count on it. I will see to it that enough water begins flowing through that dam to provide for the Indians.
You do that, Colonel, and I guarantee you'll have no trouble from Kitano. As for the rest, I'll stop Chitopa.
Ponce had lain in the cave for 2 days, looking over at the rotten piece of meat that had been his leg. The stench of it was overpowering. But until now, he had not been able to move well enough to get away from it. His horse had found the little graze within hobble range, as well as a puddle of water from the last rain. But now, even it was beginning to dry up. And if Ponce didn't get out of there, he and the horse faced the possibility of dying of thirst. The horse was actually faring better than Ponce. Ponce hadn't eaten in 2 days. Oddly, though he knew he should be ravenously hungry, he had no appetite. He had taken a few sips of water, having filled his canteen from the catch pool, and he had taken a few sips of laudanum, just enough to make the pain manageable. For the last 2 days, Ponce had run a fever, but now, for the first time since his self-amputation, he felt that the fever was gone. The bleeding had also stopped, and the pain in his stub had subsided to a dull throb. If he was ever going to make it into Mesquite, now was the time to do it. Painfully and laboriously, Ponce managed to get his horse saddled. Then he tried to mount. Automatically, he swung his right leg, or what should have been his right leg, over the horse's back for balance and to carry him onto the saddle. But the leg wasn't there, and Ponce's attempt to get mounted left him badly off balance. He felt himself slipping, made a desperate grab for the saddle horn, missed, and fell hard onto his wounded stump. Ponce lay there for a long moment trying to regain his composure. Then he tried to mount again. This time he held tightly onto the saddle horn until he was seated. The sensation of sitting in the saddle with one leg in the stirrup was unsettling, but he knew it was something he'd have to get used to.
Come on now, horse. Let's get.
Ponce rode out into the bright sunlight and headed for Mesquite. The little town was 10 miles ahead, and he figured on making it in 2 hours, given that he had no intention of trying to hurry. That evening, when Corporal Mixon returned to the guardhouse, still seething over his run-in with the sheriff and his deputy, he saw Private Carter lying on the bunk, waiting for the next relief change. Carter would be posted as one of the guards of the next relief. Like Corporal Mixon, Private Carter had been in the Army for many years, and like Mixon, Carter had been up and down the ranks. Last month he'd been a sergeant, but he'd gotten into a drunken fight with a cowboy over a whore he'd met in a saloon in Papago. His 30 days in jail in Papago were counted as unauthorized absence from his duty post, so he was busted. Now Carter had to perform the post duties just like any other private.
Carter, what the hell are you doing here? I'm on the next relief, remember?
Oh, yeah, I forgot.
Hey, come on down to the sutler's store and have a little drink with me. We got time.
Why, don't mind if I do.
Carter hopped from the bunk and followed his friend. It never dawned on him to suggest that what they were doing was against Army regulations. As the two men sat in the sutler's store drinking whiskey, Mixon related the story of his run-in with the two civilians who had come onto the post this afternoon.
This deputy? What a bastard! I'd like to know just who he thinks he is, coming in here like he owns the place. Oh, shit, he marched in to see the colonel without so much as a fairly goddamn well.
Are you talking about the fella that was with Sheriff Corbin?
It was easy enough for the sutler to overhear their conversation. It was right in the middle of duty hours and nobody else was in the place.
Yeah, the deputy.
Oh, shit. He was no deputy.
Sure he was. At least that's what Sheriff Corbin said.
Well, maybe that's what Corbin said, and maybe he's acting as a deputy right now. But I'll tell you this, he sure as hell ain't no ordinary deputy. Don't you know who that was?
No.
That was Falcon McAllister.
Falcon McAllister? Are you sure?
Who's Falcon McAllister?
He's a gunfighter.
Do you know him?
Well, I've never met him, but I've sure as hell heard of him.
Then how do you know that it was Falcon McAllister?
I know because I used to live in Tombstone. He ran with the Earps and Doc Holliday.
God damn.
Corporal Mixon's awe suddenly turned to fear as he remembered that McAllister had threatened to kill him. His hands started shaking, and some of the whiskey in his glass splashed out.
You all right, Mixon?
Yeah, I'm all right. Sutler, could you bring us another round, please?
Nearly an hour after what should have been the changing of the guard, Lieutenant Kirby, the officer of the day, showed up at the sutler's store and found Corporal Mixon and Private Carter stinking drunk. Under the escort of two guards, Mixon and Carter returned to the guardhouse, but no longer as part of the guard detail. They were prisoners. When Private Wilson came into the guardhouse a little later, he threw his hat onto the bunk in anger.
What the hell's going on around here? I was an hour late getting relieved.
Ask those fellas we put in jail.
Wilson walked to the back and saw Corporal Mixon and Carter behind bars.
Corporal Mixon? Sergeant Carter, what are you two doing in here?
That's Private Carter.
Oh, yeah. But what are you doing in here?
I'll tell you what. You wait until the others are asleep, then come back here and we'll tell you.
Why should I wait until the others are asleep?
Because I'm going to tell you where my money is, and I don't want anyone else to hear it. Shh. Wait until the others are asleep, then come back.
All right.
Private Wilson walked back up to the front of the guardhouse and lay on his bunk with his hands laced behind his head. Unlike Carter and Mixon, Wilson had been in the Army for less than a year, and he had never been anything but a private. It was also likely that he would never be anything but a private. Wilson had grown up on a farm in Missouri and left when a young girl on a neighboring farm got pregnant and named him the culprit. Wilson knew it was possible that he could be the father. Of course, he could think of four other fellows that might be the daddy, too. Well, he flat out was not ready to get married yet, especially if he was going to be tricked into it. So he left in the middle of the night and went to St. Louis, where he enlisted at Jefferson Barracks. He regretted it almost immediately, and wished many times that he was back home, even if he did have to get married. Besides which, Lou Ellen wasn't that bad-looking a girl. He could have done worse. An hour later, Wilson got up from his bunk and walked quietly back to the cell.
You fellas asleep?
Nope, we are awake.
Mixon and Carter appeared just on the other side of the bars, barely visible in the little ambient light that was available.
All right, I'm here. Now what's this about your money?
It's not just my money. It's Carter's money, and it is your money, too. If you have balls enough to come with me tonight to get it.
Come with you tonight? How am I going to go anywhere with you tonight? You're in jail.
You got that, did you?
Well, yeah, I mean...
Get the keys to the cell. They're on the corporal's desk.
How am I going to do that with him there?
He'll be posting the new relief soon. When he does, all you have to do is get the keys and let us out.
I don't know.
Look, you've been bitching and moaning ever since you come in about how much you hated the Army, haven't you? Well, this is your chance. Let us out and we'll go get the money and then we can go our own separate freedom-loving ways.
All right. All right, soon as the new relief is posted, I'll get the key and let you two out.
Although Ponce reached Mesquite before dark, he decided to stop outside town and wait until the sun had set because he didn't want to ride in while it was still daylight. While he was waiting for nightfall, he utilized his time by finding a stout staff, cutting it to the right size, then crossing it at the top with a bar that would fit under his arm. The result was a usable crutch. It would have worked better if he had had something with which to pad the armrest, but he had used his extra shirt and pants as bandages over the stump of his leg. During his wait, he also ate a handful of grasshoppers and the fruit of a saguaro cactus. It was the first food Ponce had put in his belly in 3 days. When night came, he waited outside town listening to the sounds of night creatures. He dozed off a couple of times, but woke himself up every time because he didn't want to sleep through the night out there. When he figured it was about midnight, Ponce remounted and rode into town. He had purposely waited until it was this late because he didn't want to be seen. He knew that someone who came riding into town with only one leg would not only be noticed, he would also be remembered. The town was very dark, with not a flicker of light from anywhere, not even from the cantina. But the bright full moon painted a soft silver halo around all the buildings and laid a shimmering path on the road before Ponce. That provided him with enough illumination to ride down the familiar street until he reached the leather goods store. His horse didn't like going through the narrow passageway between the leather goods store and the apothecary, especially as the two buildings crowded out what little light there was from the moon. But Ponce cajoled the animal, kicked with his one good leg until they were through and into the open area that lay between Susie's crib and the rear of the leather goods store. The inside of the crib, like every other building in town, was totally dark. Ponce took his horse around behind the crib and tied it off in the lean-to shed. The lean-to was less for the comfort of the animals and more for the convenience of Susie's customers, who just might not want the presence of their horses to give away the fact that they were visiting a soiled dove. With his horse secure and out of sight, Ponce used his crutch to come around to the front of the little house. He reached up to the eave where he knew she kept an extra key, but it wasn't there. He felt around a bit more, but still couldn't come up with a key. Finally, he gave up the search.
Susie! Susie!
Go away. Too damn late to do any business.
Susie, it's me, Ponce. Will you open the damn door?
Ponce?
Yeah. Open the door, will you? I can't find the key.
Well, that's because I don't leave it out there anymore.
Let me in.
Just a minute.
The reason I don't keep the key out there anymore is because Fargo... Oh, my God, Ponce! What happened to you?
If you let me come in, I'll tell you all about it.
Yeah, come in.
Seeing the bed, Ponce hopped over to it, then flopped down.
Have you got anything to drink?
I've got some whiskey.
Water first, then whiskey. And maybe something to eat.
All I have in the house is a jar of peaches preserves.
That'll do. But first, I need a drink of water.
Susie scooped a dipper of water from the water bucket and handed it to Ponce.
More.
My, you are thirsty, aren't you?
You said something about peach preserves?
Oh, yeah, right here.
Thanks. I don't need no spoon.
Holy shit, Ponce. How long's it been since you ate?
I had me some grasshoppers this morning. You'll eat them if you're hungry enough.
What happened to your leg?
I cut it off. Can you believe that shit? I cut off my own leg. I had the gangrene. It was either cut off my leg or die. And since I'm rich, I wasn't particularly ready to die yet.
What are you talking about?
I'm rich, Susie. I got more money than me or you has ever seen. After I lay up here for a few days, me and you are going to leave this town. Maybe go back to St. Louis or New Orleans or even out to San Francisco. We'll go first class by train. And when we get there, we'll live like a king and queen. What do you think of that?
I don't know yet. Is this the same money that Fargo was talking about?
Fargo? Fargo's in town?
No, he was here, looking for you. But he's not here now.
You sure he's not here?
Yeah, I'm sure.
That's good.
But he come here looking for you, all right. He wants to kill you.
Yeah, I reckon he does.
What's all this about, Ponce? Where did all this money come from that you and Fargo were talking about? And how'd you wind up with it?
We robbed a stagecoach and stole $15,000. Then I got hurt in the leg and caught me a case of the gangrene. Fargo was going to leave me without giving me my share. So I let on as I was in a lot worse shape than I was. Then, when Fargo and the others wasn't expecting it, I stole all the money and lit out. But my leg was bad. And over the next couple of days after I stole the money and started running, it started in getting a lot worse. Pretty soon, I knowed that if I didn't do something soon, I was going to die. I didn't have me no choice but to cut off my leg. So, that's just what I done. I hacked her off, clean as a whistle.
Who? How in the world could you do such a thing?
Well, wasn't all that hard. I used to be a butcher. And a good one, too. I've carved up pork and beef lots of times. And I've cut a lot of legs off and hogs and steers. And to tell you the truth, Susie, cutting off a human leg was lots easier.
Well, that was your own leg that you cut off. Didn't it hurt?
Oh, you're damn right it hurt. But hell,
It was already hurting, and I had me some laudanum, so that helped. After that, I just waited till I healed up some, and here I am.
So, where's the money now? Do you have it with you?
No, I don't have it with me. I got it hid. I figured if Fargo and the others happened to catch up with me, that might be about the only thing that would keep them from killing me as soon as they seen me.
Yeah. And yeah, I see what you mean.
Listen, Susie, I'm going to need to stay here for a few days till I get stronger. So you can't be bringing no business in till then.
Oh, shit. Well, here we go. You can't ask me to do that, Ponzi. I've got to make a living.
Ponzi reached down into his pocket and pulled out $100.
No, you don't. This'll take care of you for the next few days. And once I'm on my foot again, and we're out of here, there's lots more where that came from.
What'll I tell my customers?
Tell them you're taking care of a sick aunt. Tell them anything. Just don't bring no one here.
All right.
Ponzi lay back on the bed and closed his eyes.
Don't wake me till breakfast time.
2 days later, Mixon, Carter, and Wilson found themselves on the west side of the Kikitoa Range, a good 80 miles from the post. The horses were now hobbled, while the men were poking around in one of the many washes that came down from the side of the mountain.
They say the washes are the best place to look. The gold is flushed down after a rain and collects in the washes.
You lied to me, Mixon.
How'd I lie to you?
You told me if I let you and Carter out, you'd take me to your money. You didn't tell me we'd have to look for gold to find it.
Well, hell, boy, gold is money, ain't it?
You sure there's gold out here?
Hell yes, there's gold. And if there's not gold, there's silver. Now, why do you think the government is keeping the U.S. Army out here, huh? It's to keep the Indians off the back of the prospectors while they look for gold.
That's the truth of it, Wilson. We're here to make it safe for the prospectors and the miners.
Yeah, and I'll be damned if I'm going to risk my neck for someone else to get rich. If I'm going to risk my neck, I'm going to risk it for me.
Damn right.
I don't think I'd have let you two out of jail if I'd have known you was just talking about maybe finding some gold or silver.
It's more than just a maybe. It's out here for real.
What do you think, Corporal? You got any idea where to look?
Look, you don't have to call me Corporal anymore. We ain't in the Army right now.
Yeah, well, as far as the Army is concerned, we are still in the Army. I mean, it ain't like they gave us papers cutting us loose or anything.
I sort of wish we still was in the Army. At least then we got to eat, which we ain't been doing much of since we deserted.
We did not desert. We are absent without leave. And there's a difference. Deserters can be shot or hung, but if we're just absent without leave, the most they can do is send us to Fort Leavenworth for a couple of years.
Yeah. But how do we convince the Army we was just absent without leave and not deserters?
'Cause we are still carrying a Army-issue pistol, that's why. And as long as we got any part of the Army still with us, well, we ain't exactly deserted.
Don't listen to Mixon. He's spouting off that barracks law bullshit. Don't fool yourself, kid. If they find us, they're gonna hang us.
Well, even if we're carrying these pistols, like Corporal Mixon said?
Hell yes. Even if we're carrying these pistols. Fact is, that'll make it worse. They'll hang us for deserting the Army and for stealing Army property.
Shit! Wish I was back in Missouri.
Oh, doing what? Walking behind a plow horse? Is that what you want to do for the rest of your life? Plow?
And if you don't want to plow, what do you want? Spend the rest of your life in the Army?
No. I don't really want to do that either. It wasn't exactly what you'd call a good soldier.
I can't argue there. As a soldier, Wilson, you wasn't worth shit.
Well, maybe not. But you was both good soldiers. Both you've been sergeants.
That's true. Fact is, we both been sergeants more than a couple of times.
I still can't believe that you both deserted.
Unauthorized absence. We did not desert. You keep saying we deserted like that, you're going to wind up getting our asses hung.
I wouldn't worry none about getting hung, Mixon. We probably ain't going to live that long.
What are you talking about? Look over there.
Carter pointed to the next ridge line.
Holy shit!
Six Apache Indians were coming toward him, riding fast and spread out in a long line.
Well, hell, there's just six of them. We'll take cover behind these rocks over there.
Corporal, I only got about 3 bullets in my gun.
I've got a box of ammunition in my saddlebag.
Forget it, Carter. You'll never make it to your horse.
Shit fire!
Three return fire.
I'm out of shield!
Damn! I am too.
I saved 3 bullets.
Saved 3 bullets? What do you mean? 3 bullets ain't gonna do us no good. There's 6 of them.
There's only 3 of us.
Come on. Let's do it.
Carter got down on his knees, crossed himself, then bowed his head. Seeing him, Wilson realized what was about to happen.
Oh, shit. Oh, shit. No, we can't do this.
Johnny, trust me. You don't want these heathens to take you alive.
Come on, do it, Mickey. Do it before it's too late.
Mixon looked at Wilson. Wilson's bottom lip was trembling, but he nodded his head in the affirmative.
Yeah, you do it.
God be with us, boys.
Mixon put the gun to Wilson's temple.
Come on, Mickey. Hurry the hell up.
Mixon shot Carter. After that, he put the barrel in his own mouth.
What the hell?
By now, the Apache realized what Mixon was doing, and incensed by being cheated of the prisoners, he rushed him.
No!
Mixon grabbed one of the pickaxes they'd been working with. Buried it halfway into the head of one of the Indians. The brave fell from his horse, but before Mixon could dislodge the pickaxe, 3 Indians were off their horses and armed. Despite his struggles, they were able to tie Mixon's hands and feet with rawhide. Falcon stood in the stirrups for a moment, just to stretch away his saddle ache, then urged his horse on. That was when he saw the vultures. They were circling too warily, too cautiously, in way too many numbers for them to be attracted to but one thing. Falcon had seen them gather like this before.
Ha!
He hurried it on for the next mile until he saw what was attracting the vultures' attention. 3 naked bodies lay white and bloating in the sun. 2 of the bodies were not mutilated in any way. Both had gunshot wounds in the temple, the bullet holes black with encrusted blood. The 3rd man was staked out on the ground, his arms and legs spread out. His penis had been cut off, and from the amount of blood that had pooled between his legs, it had happened while he was still alive. His eyes were cut out, and his scalp had been lifted. But Falcon was more than reasonably sure that this was Corporal Mixon, the soldier he had encountered on his visit to Fort Lowell.
What the hell are you 3 doing out here?
Looking around, Falcon saw a bloody pickaxe, a shovel, a pretty good-sized hole, and a few rocks that had been broken into smaller pieces. That told him all he needed to know. Picking up the shovel, Falcon enlarged the hole enough to be able to take all 3 bodies. Then he cut the corporal loose and dragged him and the others over to where he had been working. He pushed them down into the hole, covered them with dirt, then moved a few rocks over the top of the grave. When he finished, he looked down at the grave. Then he recalled a legend that brought comfort to cavalrymen, and he recited a poem.
Halfway down the trail to hell, in a shady meadow green, where the souls of all the dead troopers camped, in a good old-time canteen. And this eternal resting place is known as Fiddler's Green.
According to legend, no man who had ever served in the cavalry could have possibly lived a life that was good enough to earn him a place in heaven. On the other hand, cavalrymen had all served enough penance on earth to keep them from going to hell. The alternative to heaven or hell was Fiddler's Green. A place where the water was cool, the beer was plentiful, there was always bacon with the beans, and the dance hall girls were friendly.
Corporal Mixon, you were a son of a bitch, but you deserve better than this. The others too. Save me a place, troopers.
Turning away from the hasty grave, Falcon mounted his horse and started out in pursuit of the Indians who had done this. The trail was surprisingly easy to follow. Falcon was certain that the Indians he saw were led by Chitopa, and Chitova either didn't think there were any white men capable of trailing him, or he was so confident that he didn't care if anyone trailed him or not. Falcon caught up with him in the late afternoon, then stayed well behind him so that they were totally unaware of his presence. He stayed on their trail for the rest of the day, enjoying the chase almost as if he were playing chess, move and counter-move. What made this particularly enjoyable to Falcon was the fact that he was controlling all the moves. When night fell, Falcon became much more careful in his tracking. He knew that Chitopa would not travel at night, and he didn't want to suddenly ride in on him. In order to prevent that, Falcon had decided to dismount. Now he led his horse through the darkness, picking his way very carefully so as not to dislodge any stones that would give him away. Then, on the desert floor in the darkness ahead, he saw the glow of a campfire. If they had known they were being trailed, they would have made a cold camp. So far, he still had the advantage of secrecy. As Falcon ground hobbled his horse, he thought of Diablo, who had served him faithfully for so many years. Diablo was old and enjoying a well-earned retirement on Falcon's ranch back in Colorado. He found himself wishing he had Diablo with him now, rather than the horse furnished to him by the sheriff in Oro Blanco. He and Diablo were of the same mind. He could get the response he needed by just thinking things, and that had gotten him through some very tight spots over the years. This horse was not Diablo, but Falcon had to admit that it had served him well, and he patted his mount affectionately on its face a couple of times.
You've done a good job, and don't let anyone ever say otherwise. Now what I want you to do is stay here and be quiet until I get back.
Falcon looked around, marking the position so that he could find his way back in the dark. Then he started toward the Indian camp. The moon was full, and there were a few clouds in the sky. From time to time, one of the clouds would pass over the moon, and when it did so, it would shine silver during its transit. At those times, a shadow would fall across the desert floor. Falcon utilized those opportunities to advance forward. Whenever the moon was out, he would try to remain in the shadows of a saguaro cactus or a rock outcropping. Sometimes he would find a depression and move forward and defilade. As he approached the camp, he could smell something cooking over the fire. He didn't know whether it was a rabbit, a snake, or some bird they had killed. Whatever it was, he was glad they were cooking, because the smell of cooking would mask any scent the Apache or one of their horses might get of Falcon as he approached. Standing there, still and quiet, Falcon took the opportunity to look around. That was when he picked out a shadow within a shadow, noticeable only because it was even blacker than the surrounding darkness. The shadow was an Indian, a guard perhaps, though Falcon knew that Indians rarely posted guards. The shadow stood up. That gave Falcon the opportunity to move forward several feet. He advanced through the night as silently as the clouds overhead. As he came closer to the Apache on guard, he pulled out his Arkansas toothpick. Falcon moved closer, ever closer, until he was but inches behind the rock the guard had chosen to use as his backrest. The guard sat back down and leaned back against the rock. The rock only came halfway up the Indian's back, which was very good for Falcon's purposes. Falcon raised up, put his arm around the Indian, and clamped his hand down on the Indian's mouth. Falcon drew his knife across the Indian's neck in one quick slice, severing his jugular. He jerked his hand away as blood gushed from the wound. The Indian fell back, flopped a few times like a fish out of water, then died. Falcon cut around the base of the Indian's scalp, then turned him over on his belly. Putting his foot in the middle of the Indian's back, Falcon grabbed the Indian by his hair, then jerked. The scalp came off cleanly. Falcon debated for a moment or two as to whether he should take the scalp with him. Then he decided against it. Instead, he cut a coup stick, put the scalp on the stick, then rolled the Indian over on his back and forced open the dead man's mouth. He then stuck the bottom of the coup stick into the open mouth, using it as a support mount for the stick. Falcon left then, creeping away as quietly and as carefully as he had arrived, to let him find their brother, neatly and expertly scalped, with no sign of
who did it. The sun was high overhead, a brilliant white orb in a fixed blue sky. It beat down mercilessly on the four men who rode across the desert floor.
Hey, Fargo, you sure you know where we are?
Yeah, I know.
You sure? Because I don't want to get lost out here and maybe have someone find our bones about 100 years from now. What do you think so funny?
Someone finding our bones 100 years from now.
I don't think that's funny. I don't think that's funny at all.
Well, you three, shut the hell up. It's too damn hot to be listening to the three of you bullshitting all the damn time.
Well, I'd like to know just where the hell we are. I mean, we was heading north when we left town. Next thing you know, we start curving around. We was going west for a while. Now, damn if it don't seem we're going south. If you ask me, we're just riding in circles. And when a fella starts riding in circles, that means he's lost.
We ain't lost! We're doubling back is all.
Doubling back? Doubling back for what? If you hadn't shot that son of a bitch back in Mesquite, we wouldn't have to be out here and we wouldn't be hot. We'd still be sitting in a nice, cool saloon, drinking beer and talking with the women.
And eating.
Yeah, and eating.
What the hell did you shoot that son of a bitch for anyway?
I told you why I shot him. I thought it was Pawnee.
What if it had been Pawnee and he had hid the money somewhere? Then he would be dead and we wouldn't have no money or no idea where it was. Did you think of that?
No, I reckon I didn't. All I could think of was the son of a bitch stole money from us and I wanted to kill him.
Hey, Casey, you got anything left to eat? Jerky or something?
No.
How about you, Monroe? You got any jerky?
I ain't got nothing all left.
Son of a bitch. I'm hungry.
Yeah, me too. I could damn near eat this saddle.
Quit your belly aching, all of you. You think I ain't hungry? You don't hear me bitching about it, do you?
Well, what are you gonna do about it? You're the leader, ain't you? Leastwise, you've been claiming to be the leader. You're the reason we had to hightail it out of Mesquite. So by my way of thinking, that means it's up to you to find us something to eat.
Yeah, you're the leader. Do some leading. Get us something to eat.
All right. There's a ranch up ahead. We'll get something to eat there.
Well, how? We're gonna just walk up to the front door and say, excuse me, but we're awful hungry, and we was wondering if maybe you could feed us.
Something like that.
Well, I ain't one for begging. I like to earn my keep.
Earn it? Dagan, what the hell do you mean, earn it? You're a thief, for Christ's sake. We're all thieves.
Yeah, well, that's earning it, sort of.
Where is that ranch, anyhow? Because I sure don't see nothing that looks like a ranch.
It's just up ahead a little ways. Another couple miles is all.
You sure about that?
Yes, I'm sure about that. I told you I used to live around here. Facts is, I worked on this ranch once. It's the Double R Ranch. Double R for Raymond Reynolds.
How come you quit ranching?
Because the only thing dumber than a cow on a cattle ranch is the men who are dumb enough to punch them. You're either too hot or too cold, too wet or too dry, and you ain't never got two nickels to rub together in your pocket. I had me a belly full of it, so I just upped and quit.
I always thought I'd kind of like to be a cowboy.
You'd make a good cowboy.
I would?
Yeah. You're just exactly what all the ranchers is looking for. Someone who's dumb enough to do it.
I ain't all that dumb.
You ain't?
No.
You're riding with me, ain't you? Anyone who'd ride with me is dumber than shit.
Hey, when you say that, you're saying that about all of us.
Including yourself.
I'm especially talking about myself.
They rode on in silence for another few miles. Then Pargo pointed toward a ranch house in the distance.
There it is, just like I told you.
Dagan and the two other riders started sloping down a long hill toward the main house.
Where are you going?
Toward the ranch house? Did you say we get something to eat?
Yeah, but not there. Come this way.
Pargo cut his horse off to the left, at almost a right angle to the way they'd been going.
What are we going that way for? That's the house over there, ain't it?
Yeah, but I told you we're not going to the house.
Well, if we ain't going to the house, just where the hell are we going?
You'll see.
Pargo led him on for about 2 more miles. And though Dagan and the others were anxious to know what was going on, it seemed clear enough by his determination that Pargo definitely did have something in mind. And at this point, there was nothing they could do but follow.
There it is. That's where we'll get our next meal.
Pargo pointed to a small adobe cabin that rose like a clump of dirt from the desert floor.
Yeah, I see what you're up to now.
Wait a minute. That's what we come all this way for? A little dirt hut like that? What the hell is it?
Monroe, if you'd ever done one day's work in your life, you'd recognize it. It's a lion shack.
What's a lion shack?
It's where the cowboys that watch over the herds in the field stay. It's lonely work, but as I recall, most of the time the cowboys in the line shack eat better than the boys back in the bunkhouse.
I've heard that my own self, but I ain't never spent no time in a line shack.
I have, and believe me, whoever's in there now will have food.
What if they do have food? You don't really think they'll just share it with us, do you?
Well, I don't intend to ask them. I intend to take it. Dismount. Pour your long guns and follow me. You'll be needing them.